From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour began July 19, 1848 in Seneca Falls, setting of the first Women's Rights Convention. The groundbreaking event even questioned the role of women in society and began a heated debate about a woman's right to vote. Well, in part because of the work of what you might call first-wave feminists and suffragettes, women slowly gained rights like the ability to own property, the right to divorce, and on August 26, 1920, the right to vote across all 50 states. Feminism's so-called second wave came in the 1960s, a cultural movement. The movement drew attention to social inequalities, including the right of a woman to hold the same types of jobs as men, gain certain reproductive rights, and own their own sexuality. Well, we've moved into the era of third or even fourth wave feminism. Over the decades, women of all races and socioeconomic backgrounds have come forward to have their voices included in the conversation, which has been criticized for being mostly for middle-class Anglos. Well, not really anymore. Today, feminism is everywhere. It's online, videos on YouTube, memes on Facebook and Twitter that spur further public debate and even question the need for feminism in the 21st century. A campaign in January called Women Against Feminism was launched. It now has 21,000 likes on Facebook, and in the last few weeks, it sparked kind of a counter meme online called I Need Feminism Because. So we're trying to define modern feminism as I think a thoughtful, broad, and accurate definition as we can do here, and we've got a great panel to help us do that. Let me start by thanking my colleague Michelle Faust, who she and I were talking last week about this kind of the I don't need feminism because and the counter movement, and we realized that there's quite a discussion here that we couldn't even have in an hour, but we'll try.
That's exactly right. So I am very much online on Facebook and on Twitter, and I kept seeing this and seeing articles about it and said, Evan, we need to talk about this.
Here we
so
do.
Here we are.
And here we are. And so we've got here's our panel, and we'll take your calls, and we'll have a good conversation, we hope, this hour. We've got Dr. Barb Lee Savoy. She's the director of the Women and Gender Studies at the College at Brockport. Dr. Lee Savoy, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
In studio, we have a couple of young feminists, I think it's fair to say. Noelle Evans is here, and Noelle was, among other things, an activist in the Occupy Wall Street movement, spoke on WBAI as a voice in the women of OWS during the time, and she's in filmmaking and, in general, I think, part of the movement locally. So nice to see you, Noelle.
Yeah, you too.
Nice to have you in studio. And Melanie West is here. Melanie is an activist, a political illustrator, and a proud feminist as well. Melanie, nice to see you.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
On the phone is Hannah Murphy. Hannah is with Feminists for Nonviolent Choices, an organization that has many iterations in Rochester. You might have seen some of their film work. And Hannah is responsible for organizing an educational series of events for Feminists for Nonviolent Choices as part of the Gandhi Institute's annual Season for Nonviolence. Hannah, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for inviting me, Evan.
A lot of different things to talk about, and I think it's important, as Michelle and I were talking about, to start with definitions. And let me start with the professor, Dr. Lee Savoy, about, in general, the question of the definition of feminism. So Barb, earlier today I asked on social media, what comes to mind when you hear the word feminism? Mm-hmm. And the responses were all over the place. Absolutely fascinating. Some of the men said they think it means militant anti-guyism. Many of the people said it means progress and equality. But is there a general definition that you would give to students or people in a conversation about it?
Yeah, I think it's about equality for all people. And I think the problem is when we start tagging it to a particular category of identity, or perhaps a period in history where it was reaching for a particular issue. But I think it's very broad, and the more that we can think about that in its broadest sense, the more it has application to everyone. So sex and gender equality for all people is really at the center of that definition.
Let me ask Melanie West, same question. How would you, when you talk to friends about what is feminism, what would you say?
I think the definition we got before is actually really beautiful, because I think one of the issues when it comes to defining feminism is that theory that you just brought up, that men worry about the feminism is some type of reversal of the social stratification. And it comes with this assumption that one gender, one sex identity has to be dominating another. And that's not what feminism is about. Feminism is about smashing patriarchy because it's not beneficial for anybody. You know, feminism is about making sure that everybody can find self-actualization and come into themselves in a way that is comfortable for them and in a way that they won't be policed or denied or discriminated against because they're not following very rigid socially constructed norms that are, again, about stratifying, dismissing, and excluding people from taking part in political process or just living in general.
So not about putting one gender down. It's about true equality. And by the way, the roots of feminism, you can go back several thousand years, well BC, mm-hmm. well before. I mean, sometimes we talk about feminism as if it's 20 or 30 or 100 years old, yeah, Dr. Lissaboy, and it goes back far, much farther than that, right?
Absolutely. So if you go back to the very beginning, you can see these, you know, and also in other cultural spaces. So we tend to think about feminism as being in this Western space, but there's so much of movements that we see prior to that and in other geographical areas. So I think we have to look in a bigger space.
All right. Noelle, definition from you, feminism?
I feel like it's been said.
You're happy with what you've heard?
Yeah.
She's co-signing on what she's heard here. She warned me that Mel would be a dynamo, mm-hmm. And that was a great definition, Mel.
Thank you.
And let me ask Hannah, same question for you, because I know when you work for Feminists for Nonviolent Choices, you probably get asked quite often, what does feminism mean to you?
I love everything that's been said so far, and I think that it's one of the reasons I don't understand this whole campaign of I don't need feminism is because I don't think any woman would disagree with feminism as it is defined. I think that what the ladies here have shared is we're not talking about what my philosophical take on feminism is or what your philosophical take, but we're going back to the Merriam-Webster dictionary, we're opening it, and we're saying feminism is the theory of the political, economic, and social equality of the sexes. And I don't understand how any woman could say, I don't need that.
Hmm. It's a fair point. So mm-hmm. Let me turn to Michelle Faust then, because the campaign, again, started in January. It has been all over the place lately, the meme of I don't need feminism because, and Michelle, you've pulled some of the comments. There are many, many, many of them, but what are some of the ones that you've seen?
There are definitely hundreds of them, and if you Google I don't need feminism, you'll see all the images. It usually is a woman standing there with a handwritten card
yep.
and a photo, and so you can read on the photo things that say I don't need feminism because I don't blame what a few guys did wrong on the whole gender when females can be just as cruel. Another one that said, I don't need feminism because I'm a strong, educated woman who won't make myself a victim. I don't need feminism because they tell women they're intrinsically beautiful, but tell men they're potential rapists. And I don't need feminism because it only supports and advocates for women, and they don't even do that properly. The fight for equality should be left to people who, at the very least, make a minimal effort not to be fascist.
Okay, so those are some of the examples, again, of the thousands of I don't need feminism because. And I want to zero in on a point and ask Dr. Lissaboy, again, the director of Women and Gender Studies at the College at Brockport here. One woman was saying, I don't need to be a victim, as if the notion of feminism is rooted in victimhood. And the odd thing to me is that women have been oppressed in large ways for thousands of years. I mean, essentially, since civilization began, men have had more political power, more rights in society, more freedom in terms of occupation, et cetera. So is it strange to you as it is to me that this notion that feminism would be rooted in false victimhood?
Well, it's not strange to me, but I want to re-spin that slightly because I will argue that indeed male power is at the center of this. So, you know, patriarchy rules and there are multiple categories of identity that we see operating in the margins. But I also want to argue that I think it's 2014, we're on the cusp of 2015, and I think we really need to re-spin this conversation in ways that's relative to young men, women, and multiple identities. So I think one of the things that's important is to just disrupt this whole notion of man, woman, female, masculine, and think about the multiple ways that we construct and understand identity. And that's a starting point to re-engage the conversation. So that to think of women in a space of victimhood doesn't deny the fact that there are women as victims and doesn't deny the power structure of patriarchy as, you know, the dominant structure. But it also recognizes there are multiple victims. There are multiple spaces in which individuals fall into a space of victim because of imbalances in power. And so we really need to start looking looking at feminism as a broader space and understand these multiple spaces of identity. So I don't think it serves women very well to think about being in a space that is disempowered, if I can use that word, despite the fact that you're in perhaps a subversive role, perhaps that you're operating under, you know, this larger power structure that's largely male. But I think it's important to recognize that within that there are also other identities that are existing in the margins. So this broader definition of how we understand feminism, how we understand oppression, is a really important piece of this feminist discourse today.
Noelle, one of the criticisms of feminism that Michelle was reading from there lies in this notion that it is about turning all men into rapists or hating on men, etc. What do you make of the notion that some people view feminism as sort of knee-jerk anti-guyism is what somebody described it to me as today? What do you think?
Well, I think there's a discord there between feminism and misandry, and not all feminists feel that way. There are some who I think would go to that extreme, but coming back to feminism itself, we're looking at an issue where we do have a rape culture in place in society, and people will argue that that doesn't necessarily exist because maybe perhaps it's ingrained within them, but you have common things said like boys will be boys, and this sort of mentality that men can't be changed from birth to think in a certain way that maybe we're equal and I don't need to push you or overpower you in a way to get what I want without your consent. So I'm trying to reel it back
in. Well, here's what I'm hearing from you. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing that there's a difference between, you used the term misandry.
Mm-hmm. And
Hatred of men. And acknowledging the fact that look what happened in Santa Barbara. That's not all men. Okay, that's nuts. And good thing is, I don't think it's most men. But there is a notion that is, there's a strong undercurrent in some circles, especially young men, that seem to view sexuality in still very, Dr. Lisa Voy, what
heteronormative terms?
Okay.
I would say.
Yeah.
And it threatens, it threatens male power. And so I think the tendency is to jump to this space of putting feminism in a really narrow anti-male category when we see it as a much broader space. So the challenge to rape culture is really important.
But that's not misandry. Challenging rape culture is not equated to misandry.
Absolutely. So I think, again, you know, the point when you go to that extreme, when you put it in this category of misandry, I think, you know, it's a knee-jerk kind of kickback reaction to power structures that are being threatened.
I think that's well said. Mel, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I was just totally going to agree with that because I think that the way that the sexuality that we're discussing, the heteronormative male, you know, sexuality that we're discussing is largely based around violence, which is something that I feel like our media and our culture in general has tried to downplay and normalize as best they can. And I think some historical context is really important here. When you have like a social strata, meaning that there are some bodies that have been privileged over others, there are some bodies that have been regulated as an underclass to become subservient to others, you need violence to do that, you know. And if we look at the history of feminism and the way that women have been subordinated, it was through violent force. And so when you have a society that, you know, relates to bodies and encourages bodies to relate to each other in such a domineering, violent way, then that's going to become a part of sexuality. And, I mean, we see that everywhere, like, especially, I think, in movies and in other parts of media, you know, the very virile, the very, you know, handsome, courageous, heroic male is typically very violent. And a woman, you know, falls in love often by succumbing to the man. And so when we have pushbacks against rape culture, I think that, again, it's people who are afraid of the power structure crumbling because this sexuality that is, again, based around violence is a reflection of a larger structure. And if women are willing to stand up and say that I'm not going to be seduced by abuse, I'm not going to be seduced by violence, and I'm not not going to find myself in being subservient to you or succumbing to you or accommodating you, then that's going to flip the strata and we won't have a strata anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what scares people.
Yeah.
Before I get to the phones, because every phone line is now
lit
up. But before I do, I want to, you mentioned violence. Now, Hannah Murphy, who's on the line with us, is with Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. And I am not going to get this hour bogged down with a debate within feminism about whether you can be feminist but pro-life. But part of the ethos of Feminists for Nonviolent Choices is does go in that direction. And so, Hannah, let me just briefly ask you, because I know this has come up and this is something that, that you and your organization have dealt with a lot. Why do you view a pro-life position within the important overall culture of feminism?
Well, to start, I think, like, I agree with the ladies and what they were saying, that feminism isn't about hating men, and it's not about wanting to be men. excuse me. What we're looking for is that men and women are on equal ground in regard to social, economic, and political equality. And I think that when we come to our standpoint on pro-life feminism, we acknowledge that violence against women and men happens from conception to natural death. And for us, abortion doesn't happen in a vacuum, okay? That there are social and economic problems that put women in the position of feeling that their only choice is abortion. And what we aim to do is bring attention to those human rights violations, which is why, I mean, it, interestingly enough that we were talking about the hypersexualized female, that was our focus last year for our annual series, was the sexual objectification of women and girls. And there is a rape culture, and that was one of the, is it the memes that I saw, was rape culture is a lie. And that's really scary that a woman would think that, because there are video games that promote rape, rape of 14-year-old girls, and that's the goal of the game, is to simulate this rape. And I think that for us, marketing promotes the hypersexualized and the submissive females, like the ladies were saying. And so in that, she's left in this situation of feeling if she's not going to submit, then she is anti-man or a prude or that kind of stuff. I don't know if I think I ventured off of your original question there.
But in general, what you're saying is a lot of that mentality then your organization believes pushes women into believing that abortion is the only choice, and that you're trying to push back against that?
Right. We try to counter the culture and say, listen, there are things that are going on here socially and economically that put women in this position of, listen, you can't go to school if you're pregnant. So I don't want to miss out on going to school and having an education. I want to have a career. It puts women in this position of liberating the body from reproduction. And this is not, you know, all feminists, but some feminists, it's like this idea that if you're a mother, it's like you're a slave to motherhood. And the biology of a woman's body, that's what makes us unique. You know, we want to be on equal ground with men, but there is something there that makes us, like, unique in this and empowers us to, you know, bring life. That's pretty awesome, if I don't say so. That said, it doesn't mean that all women have to have babies or that's what they have to do. But for us, the violent act of having an abortion isn't helping women, it's hurting women.
Okay, and so let me say again, if you're on the phone, we're going to get you in just a second. I do want to let our group in studio respond, because what you're going to see here is, within feminism, there's a strong disagreement on this. My guess is Hannah and the panel in studio agree on a lot of different things about feminism, about equality, about the movement. There's going to be strong disagreement here, and that's okay. We're not going to spend the hour on it, but Mel, go ahead. I want to hear what you have to say.
The first thing I want to say is I want to address the idea about a woman's biology being, you know, really unique and beautiful. I just want to put this out here now so that we can nip it in the bud. I kind of feel like we have this unspoken notion that all we're talking about right now when we address feminism are cisgender women, and there are more than just cisgender women in feminism. There are trans women as well, so we don't have any uniform form biology that we have as women that make us unique and beautiful. Women are multifaceted. There's no one female body. And the next thing that I want to say is I do agree that we do live in a society that does not take care of living people in it. And so I do think that we should have a society that funds prenatal care, that, you know, funds public mm-hmm. education, that makes people feel confident about bringing other people into the world. But that being said, as much as that's important and that we need, you know, universal health care, we need public education funded, and we need people to feel like they know that they can go to a hospital and be taken care of if they want to allow a pack of cells to be, you know, brought to term and then given birth to as a person, there's still some people that that decision is just not going to be the best for them. And that's why feminism is about choice. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think in feminism, that's why feminism is beautiful, because you can have the choice to be pro-life, but then you can also have the choice to have mm-hmm. an abortion. And right. I think that we need a society that supports both of those things. So if you are pro-life and you would like to bring, you know, that pack of cells in your body to terms and give birth to it, we should have a society that is going to fund daycare, education, prenatal care, everything that you need and that child's going to need, whether you keep it or put it up for adoption. But if you need to have an abortion because, you know, that's just not what you want to do with your body, that also mm-hmm. needs to be funded as well.
I think it's really important that we keep our listeners in mind and in using a term like cisgender, which is not something that everyone uses in it every day. What you mean by that is a person whose gender identity and their physical gender match, that they're a yes. female in both ways.
Yes. And I'm sorry I kind of veered off from that point, because I know that the conversation I just went into applies a little bit more to cisgender women, but I just want to reiterate, even though our conversation looks like it's going to be about just cisgender women, which are, again, people yeah. who are born with anatomy that this society casts as female, there are women, and particularly feminists, outside of that realm who are trans women, and we need to acknowledge them because their voices are just as important, and obscuring them is not helping feminism.
Dr. Lisa Voy, I know you want to...
Go ahead, Hannah. I just want to say I totally agree with the last statement you just made. Mm-hmm. I totally do. So we're on the same page for that.
Okay.
So the one thing I just made a note of when Hannah was speaking, the social, economic, and political spaces of equality. And I want to say that we are within a structure, a societal structure, in which the social, political, and economic spaces really favor men, and also favor white men. So the one other piece that I would mention here in terms of categories identity is we get caught up in this very Western Eurocentric point of view. So it is something that favors men. And when we talk about reproductive freedom or reproductive justice, I think it's critical that we that context is everything, right? So that we understand the spaces under which women are free to bring children into this world under their choice. And if the circumstances under which they live are not are compromised or coerced in terms of their economic and social stability, then they're not free. So I don't think we can really have a conversation about reproductive justice or reproductive freedom until we really look at the inequality in those social and societal structures of political and economic freedom. So I so agree with my colleagues here, and I want to say that the notion of identity, while we talk about trans and queer and cisgendered identity, it's also important to also consider race, that we don't necessarily we're not necessarily having a conversation here about one category or one space of identity. It's multiple, and we must be broad in the way that we conceptualize and think about that.
Noelle, do you want to weigh in before we get back to Hannah for one last point on this?
The only thing I can think to add here is that in places where abortion is illegal, you have women whose rights are more in effect when they're corpses than when they're alive. Mm-hmm. You can do more. You can have the choice to do more with your organs dead than you can alive if you're in a place where you cannot actively, legally seek abortion.
All right, Hannah. And so we're going to – I think we should leave it there, because I know we're not going to have agreement on this, but – The last question I'd have for you, Hannah, is before we got on the broadcast today, I asked people for definitions of feminism. I had several tell me that you can't be feminist if you're pro-life. I know you've heard that, and obviously you disagree.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the problem with saying that, I think the problem and why a lot of these statements are I don't need feminism, is because what people are doing is they're seeing stereotypes. They're seeing certain people out in the public, women with whom they don't identify, and they're saying, that's not me, I don't agree with that, and if she's a feminist, I must not be. But for me, feminism is inclusive, where we stand on specific issues or how we gain social and economic rights. Those things change during time, But if we return to the simple definition of feminism, I think that's where we find common ground. And I think that what feminism is the need for women to be more supportive of women in practical ways. And I think that when, you know, like reproductive rights, this is a whole nother show. Evan, you could do a series of
yeah,
shows.
Yeah, there's no question.
You're on it.
There's
but
no
I think
question.
Today is we have cross purposes here today. And I think that it's sad to see young women saying, I don't need feminism.
I think everybody in this panel agrees on that and absolutely right. So, all right, let's do this. Let's take the shortest break in radio. The phones are filled up. We're going to get to your phone calls. And my colleague Michelle Faust has also pulled some different sound bites that kind of give you a different flavor for this discussion that's been happening online about I do or don't need feminism, X, Y, and Z. So I'm Evan Dawson. Great panel talking about modern feminism. Short break and your calls next on Connections. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Anne in Rochester. She's been waiting. Anne, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Hi, my name is Anne, and I'm a student at UV, and I am really fascinated by fourth wave feminism. I know Hannah is an advocate for this holistic movement, and I was hoping she could talk a little bit about this particular wave of feminism and how it's different compared to other waves of feminism and why that's important, specifically on the topic of violence toward preborn women, sometimes known as gendercide. So, Hannah, you could just chime in on that.
And before you do, Hannah, thanks for the call there, Anne. Before you do, Hannah, if you're just joining us, first wave feminism, and I hope Dr. Lisa Voy will correct me if I'm wrong, is generally considered more of the political equality, voting rights, et cetera.
Suffrage,
et cetera. Second wave feminism, often considered, you think 1960s, more cultural equality, women were kind of confined to certain jobs that were considered okay.
Equal pay for equal rights.
Equal pay for equal rights.
Yeah, yeah.
Third wave, I'm hearing, is more of a sort of a reconstitution, a correction of second wave, but I don't really know. Dr. Lisa, how would you define third wave?
Yeah, I think it's really hard to put these in waves, but the movements do have periods and boundaries around them. I think the third wave is more about sexual equality, introduction of the birth control pill, you know, kind of getting voice and rights. And I think the fourth wave is something that, you know, there's a lot of talk about fourth and fifth waves and ways we understand movements. So if we just think about what's the movement, what are the issues that tend to define that particular point in time, that becomes the wave.
And so, Hannah, we tried to get away from this, but you're right back to
right, preborn,
but go ahead.
Surprise. So I'm going to keep this really short because I do think that this is a topic that we're getting a little off topic. It could be for a totally other show.
Yep.
But for us, fourth wave feminism, we go back to the first wave of feminism, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony. We're talking about rights, equal rights for all people. So
yeah,
men would be included in this. My father was like one of my major feminist influences growing up. Fourth wave feminism we see as radicalized, we see as progressive. It's beyond justice for women. It's justice for the poor, for all ethnic groups. It's justice for the unborn. Did I sum that up?
Okay, so that's okay. So now we've got some definitions that we can work with here. Let's grab Rich in Rochester. Go ahead, Rich.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good.
You know, I'm listening to this discussion, and what I call myself a male feminist. I think in the world right now, the most women are the most put upon population by far, in my eyes. And as a black male, I see it even more. You know, I just think the conversation has been twisted where everyone, even people who have fought for their own rights, are against women. And I think this talks to the great effort the conservative movements have used in language. They've used it in language against affirmative action with words like, phrases like set-asides and all those type of phrases. And I think they're doing the same thing with feminism, with these signs and using things, I'm a beautiful woman, and I know I'm a beautiful woman, so I don't need feminism. And that's what I think that these movements are missing, especially they're usually progressive movements, but I think the progressives in their plurality have missed the boat on being able to organize and concentrate and attack certain phrases, certain ways of speaking. And I think that's where the conservative movement has done such a good job, starting in the 60s up to now, that huge swing is happening. They have taken things that are really good and have perverted it through their use of language, and we on our side are at best really bad at that. And I think that really needs to be focused on. And I don't think we do a good job focusing at all.
Rich,
because
thanks.
Even right now, there's this argument between four different factions on your panel on what they see as, instead of bringing together, consolidating their efforts and focusing.
I appreciate the call, Rich. And Dr. Lisa Voy, he's drawing some historical connections there. What do you think?
Well, I think it's an interesting point. I mean, it's important to really look. It's impossible to have a conversation that's not conscious of the history. And I would also argue that those that are arguing against feminism are arguing in a way that's ahistorical. So I think this is an important point. I also recognize the comment about these fractions. And I would argue that, you know, we're having conversation right now, whereas the majority of the conversation has been a point of agreement, that we're, you know, very much in agreement about this notion of the importance of feminism, about women being marginalized and in a subordinate space. I want to mention one point, and that would be thinking about this wave or the fourth wave or going back to this conversation about movements. And I think what's really interesting now, and I think it's a great opportunity now to bring in these younger voices, is to think about the movement in a way that we define as queer or odd or not exactly fitting in. And I think that gets to your point about these other categories of identity. So we're not caught up in just talking about cisgendered women, but we're talking about multiple identities. So the fourth wave could be categorized in a way that we'd say it's a good queer movement, because we've got odd, we've got different, we've got radical, we've got the unexpected coming into the conversation. And that helps re-spin it in a way that's relative to new generations.
Melanie, want to weigh in there? Go ahead.
I just wanted to go back to the point about how, you know, there have been fractions. And I also, you know, want to agree that I think that this is a conversation and that that's important. I think that we have to understand that feminism is a humanist struggle at the end of the day. And so it's inevitable. There will be contestation. I think it's really important to stress there will never be one type of feminism, because there will never be one type of woman. And so I think what it comes down to at the end of the day is that we have to be able to fight for more than what just makes us comfortable. You know, I identify as a pro-choice feminist, but within that notion of choice, I will still fight for the woman who wants to carry a pack of cells to term and give birth and is pro-life, because it's about making sure that everybody has the ability to do what is comfortable for them. And so I don't think that contesting each other is necessarily the problem, but understanding that we're never going to have one definitive vision of feminism, and that we just need to come together around making sure that everybody has as much space and as freedom as they need to do what they need to do for themselves.
And let me just jump in before we get back to the phones and say to Rich's point, I think Rich makes an important point that says I don't need feminism because, or I'm not a victim here, often comes from people who live lives of general privilege. Mm-hmm. See, I've said in this program before, I'm a white American male born in the middle class. Dr. Lisa Voy, I hit the jackpot. I mean, if I wanted to go through life and say, hey, everybody, pull yourself up like I did, I would be blind to inequality.
Yeah.
But it's easier to do that. It's easier not to just recognize that you may have certain advantages.
Yeah, thank you so much for mentioning the word privilege, because I think that's such an important point. And I also would argue that those that are pushing this anti-feminist or I don't need feminist discourse are actually in a space of privilege or haven't really understood or been in a space that's marginalized. And thus, it's very easy to say, I don't need this because it hasn't crossed my path. Whereas, you know, having that upper hand or being in that space of privilege really gives you this other lens.
All right, I want to grab a couple more quick calls because we'll never get through all the calls this hour. It's amazing what's going on here. Let's grab Victoria in Rochester. Victoria, thanks for calling.
Hi there. I'm a college student, and I identify as a fourth-wave feminist. I've noticed that patriarchy is the term that's been used repeatedly in response to what the point of feminism is. And I was under the impression that fourth-wave feminism was more about smashing hierarchy. Would you agree with this definition of feminism being rejecting all forms of oppression and violence, not simply that within the small box?
I just want to ask all of our panelists and anyone who calls in, if you're going to use a term that isn't in our normal lexicon and every day, please define that term.
And so, but Dr. or Melanie, you want to take that? Go ahead.
Yes, I think that's a good point, because we have just been using the word patriarchy. I think a more expansive term to use is a term that black feminist bell hooks coined called white supremacist capitalist patriarchy. I think that, because I think you used the word hierarchy, and I think that using the term white supremacist capitalist patriarchy speaks more to that in fourth wave feminism, because fourth wave feminism understands that all oppression is connected, and there will be no freedom for anybody unless we smash racism, unless we smash classism, which is, of course, connected to capitalism. And that is, of course, connected to sexism.
Hannah, can you jump in on that as well?
Well, I have to speak to something that Melanie said, and maybe it encompasses just a bit. But when Melanie spoke of defending that other, that's what I think we're missing here. I think that that's one of the things that concerns me about this whole campaign of I don't need feminism, is the I in the statement. Mm-hmm. You know, I, living in a democracy, may have the right to an education. I am able to voice my social concerns, but many women, as Professor said, many women globally do not have the luxury of not needing feminism. And so feminism is not a concept created for the individual. And that's why it's so beautiful. It's for the we. So I need feminism because my sisters need feminism. So I think that that's... I don't know. I just wanted to put that out there.
Beautiful point, Hannah. And think about how many countries in the world women can't vote in, women can't hold jobs, women aren't allowed education. I mean,
drive.
We could look at Malala Yousafzai. There's a million examples you can choose, but I think Hannah's point is a beautiful one. All right, one more quick call, and then I think Michelle's got some things we've got teed up here. This is John in Rochester. Thanks for calling, John.
Hello?
John, go ahead, sir.
Oh, I'm actually from Macedon, but that's okay.
Oh, Macedon, okay.
There's been so many good points being brought up today. And also, I, as a male, I still consider myself a feminist as well. And I like the fact that people are bringing up the point that pro-choice doesn't mean that you're anti-pro-life. Somebody should be able to have that decision. But it's their decision, and that's why it's called choice. But anyways, I was also thinking that as a feminist myself, I feel that it's very important because it also means that I'm anti-prejudice, and also I feel that it works for men's favor as well, because of the fact that as a man, I'm expected to be, like, you know, tough and like sports and all of these other things that you can think are this stereotypical man point of view, and I'm not that way at all. I don't care for sports. I want to be kind and sensitive and, you know, care about the woman's feelings, you know, and be totally respectful. And I think feminism is an important part of that in order to protect men's rights as well and try to smash these stupid old values that say, hey, you're supposed to behave like this type of attitude. And I'm quite interested in what the panel has to say on that.
Yeah, John and Masson, and thanks for the call. Noel, I'll tee it up for you here, because I know you've got plenty of male friends, and they're probably a lot like John there. and John, I think, and by the way, we're laughing because I think we're laughing in support there. I mean, it's, yeah, I'm sure Noel was smiling when you were talking. It's nice to hear some of that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that when you have like this machismo attitude, it takes away from this aspect of one's identity that could be considered more feminine, not necessarily weak, but to a femininity that, and I should stress that being feminine has nothing to do with weakness, as was brought up earlier on.
Anybody ever witnessed childbirth? No kidding. I never understood why hits like a girl is supposed to be weak. Women are remarkably strong with that. But Dr. Lisa Voy, he's talking about just sort of gender expectations there. And I think it's an interesting point.
I think it really opens up the opportunity to talk about disrupting the binary and disrupting the categories that we understand as men as masculine or women as feminine, and be able to spread some of that gender capital around so women can, you know, have access to masculinity and a man can have access to femininity. And we see this... this category of gender is much more fluid. It's not a fixed space. It's not a fixed category. So we should move that around. And this is a way to help disrupt that. And I think that's a really, really great point, and really appreciate the call.
All right, Michelle Faust, what have you been checking out online?
Well, there's so much more we can talk about, and I really want to kind of bring the conversation back to the internet, because this is the situation of what is this patriarchy or this situation that we find on the internet. We see a lot of mostly misogyny, not misandry, misogyny, the hatred of women online. And so we're going to listen to a conversation. We're going to hear it from another man, Adam Savage. He's from Mythbusters. And he recently did a talk where he talked on the Moth Radio Hour, talking about how he taught his young boys about sex. And today, internet is a big thing. People learn a lot of what they learn about sex online. Now, he's talking about what he taught to his twin teenage boys because he feels that the internet is a scary place for their impressionable minds.
The thing you got to understand, bud, is the internet hates women. And I recognize there's probably those out there who are thinking that's an incredibly broad brush to paint the internet with, but let me put it this way. If you could look into someone's brain the way you search the internet, and the internet was a dude, that dude has a problem with women. I realize this is the code that I want to run, and he's old enough to run it. I want him to realize that even by the chance dint of his gender, if he's not part of the solution, he might very well be part of the problem. And I want him thinking when he talks to women, I'm one of the good ones. Thank you.
And so that was Adam Savage from Mythbusters speaking during the Moth Live Storyteller series. And he's talking about how he spoke to his children about the internet and about sex. And it's very interesting because when we talk about that, because of the way the internet can treat women, we started to see this summer, Yes All Women as a hashtag that we found on Twitter. And a lot of interesting things came out of that. It came out of the Not All Men hashtag, which I'll let you talk about a little bit further. But let me just read a couple of Yes All Women hashtags. It says, Yes All Women, because having opinions, even wholly grounded in logic, leads people to believe that I'm difficult and emotional. Yes All Women, because I have a boyfriend is the easiest way to get a man to leave you alone, because he respects another man more than you. And then Yes All Women, because the odds of being attacked by a shark are 1 in 3,748,067, while a woman's odds of being raped are 1 in 6. Yet fear of sharks is seen as rational, and being cautious of men is seen as misandry.
So that Yes All Women campaign came largely, my understanding is, after the killings in Santa Barbara, where the perpetrator of that put a video of himself before his cowardly suicide, put a video of himself out there, complaining about the fact that he was 20 years old and he didn't get the sex that he was entitled to for being a good-looking college man, and he was told that women were there to give it to him, and that Yes All Women was a campaign that was born out of that. And I want to hear from all of our panelists on this. Let me start with Dr. Lisa Voy. We've seen different campaigns over the years. I'm curious to know what you thought of the Yes All Women. That went nuclear viral very quickly.
I think there was a sense of solidarity that came out of that campaign, this sense of, you know, this is everyone. And I felt somewhat empowered by that in the way that recognized these, you know, we've been talking about multiple categories of identity that had this intersection. So that could happen to anyone. So I think there was something really important about that. And when we talk about the case in California, I think, and we see these incidences of violence in our culture, sadly, these are things that are largely perpetrated by white males. We've seen this repeat again and again. And I think that goes back to the space of privilege and what they understand, or what we understand as, you know, someone's rights or their access to capital or their access to power. And the moment that becomes challenged, I think that does fuel this cycle of violence.
Let me ask Hannah, who's got how many kids, Hannah?
Two
young kids, and you heard not only in the context of the Yes All Women campaign, but you just heard Adam Savage talking about the way to talk to kids about this.
Right.
I mean, look, no parent is perfect. Last hour we talked about the way parents get judged, but I think we want to raise our kids to respect people, respect women, respect equality. I mean, what are you doing with your own children to make sure that that happens?
Well, I think I look to my parents who raised me in such a great household where respect for one another was a mainstay. I mean, my father was a Quaker pacifist who made all the vegetarian meals and read poetry and did this. And, you know, my mom was a midwife getting her doctorate. And so I had, this was all normal to me. And I think that's what I'm so thankful for, is that I grew up within this culture of women and men not having these certain roles. And I think that the Yes All Women campaign, any campaign that confronts, you know, the commercialization of the sexualized female and the commodification of women is worthwhile. And an important thing about this Yes All Women, I think, and this is what I would say I do with my children, is I think in our culture we have lost this sharing of our stories. I think that that's something that you do beautifully on the show, Evan, is you allow people to call in and share their stories. And I think that's how we humanize one another. And I think that's how we grow to become people who don't look at each other as this or that, but just as one human entity. And that, yes, we're going to disagree on things. And yes, we're going to have opinions on my girl should wear pink when she's little. But I mean, I think that as long as we continue to share these stories with each other, then, you know, we keep that humanized element
Yeah,
there.
If we're listening. I mean, if we're willing to listen, right, to one another and realize our experience isn't a big social sample that is representative of all of society. Melanie and Noel. Melanie, first, what did you think of Yes All Women?
I would say that I actually have some, I'm trying to find a word for it, disappointment with Yes All Women. Because anytime I hear Yes All, I definitely get, I think, very justly suspicious, because I, as I made the point before, and I'd like to go back to it, there is no one type of woman, so we're not all dealing with the same thing. And I think it's really important to, again, think about specifics that certain women might be dealing with that other women aren't, and how women can actually add to each other's oppression. And so where Yes All Women becomes difficult for me is I'm an African-American woman, and when specifically Renisha McBride was slaughtered, that did not become a feminist issue, and that broke my heart, because for me as an African American woman, I have to deal with gendered violence that is also connected to my race as an African American woman, and not all women have to deal with that. And white women, specifically upper middle class white cisgender women can definitely add to my oppression, and they can add to my commodification. A very easy way to reference that in like pop culture is Miley Cyrus, and how she has appropriated the hypersexualized caricature of a black woman that allows the notion of being black and a woman to be disposable and vulgar and subhuman. And so not all women go through the same oppression. And again, I think it's very important, if this if feminism is going to be worth anything, that it be intersectional, and that we can understand that as women, as we are in oppression together, we also have the ability to oppress each other. So I think Yes All Women could tighten itself and become strengthened by understanding that not all women go through the same thing. And you can't have a Yes All Women campaign, because you might be forgetting the ways that another sister is suffering in a way that you can't imagine.
Strong stuff, Noelle. You have to follow that.
I sure do. Oh, well. I resonate with that, and I am full agreement with you. And what I think came of it from me, from reading these stories, was something that resonated with me, that though I don't go through or didn't go through some of the scenarios or experiences that these other women did, I can relate to a sense of being held down. And speaking to pop culture and the way in which black women's bodies are fetishized for either publicity stunts or for capital gain, whatever it may be, I'm totally in opposition to that. And to see that, and I'm like losing my words at the moment, unfortunately.
Melanie will do that. Maybe though, Melanie, maybe the notion of yes, all women, that may have a bit of an over blanket idea, but at the same time, maybe they'll tell you that the notion is yes, all women deal with some of this stuff, and here's what it is that men may often not think about.
Yeah.
To me, that's what I took from it. I am not dealing with the people judging me every single day on what I'm wearing and if I'm showing too little or too much skin and all that stuff. So Dr. Lisa,
one thing I want to mention that when Melanie was speaking that resonated strongly with me is this notion that bodies deceive us. So what we think, you know, is the identity or the space or the politics of a particular individual based on what we see can be deceiving. So our best allies can be in male bodies or, you know, trans bodies or cisgendered bodies. So it's multiple. And I think the important thing that we must be cautious of is to, you know, stay away from those stereotypes of what we see versus, you know, what is your point of view.
Yeah. Michelle Faust, when you came to me a week ago and said we needed to talk about this, you should have said we needed 4 or 5 hours.
That's very true.
We've burned through the hour so fast. And let me just get some quick closing thoughts here. I've got less than a minute to do it. Dr. Lee Savoy, first of all, do you see, how much change have you seen in your own teaching career from the start to now?
Oh, it's been radical. I want to say, you know, if I think of myself as a scholar going back, you know, a decade or two decades ago, it's very different than where I am today. So it's very progressive. And so I think this whole notion of really rethinking what we know and rethinking how we understand identity and rethinking the multiple, you know, spaces of that and trying to disrupt some of the dichotomies that come with just, you know, men and women and getting a much broader spectrum of that. And that really helps open the floodgates, I think, for looking at equality in much broader space.
Thank you for being here, Dr. Lee Savoy. Melanie West, great talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Noelle Evans, nice to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, yeah.
Hannah Murphy from Feminists for Nonviolent Choices. I know it's a busy day with your own kids at home. Thank you for taking the hour with us as well by phone. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, and Michelle Faust. Again, you failed. I needed 4 hours, not one on this.
Okay, sorry.
Can we come back to it?
We can.
I think we should. I didn't even think we got to everything that we had pulled
up.
Not at
all. Not
even close, really. If you called and couldn't get through, I apologize, but this is just kind of the nature of the hour. We will come back to the subject soon. I appreciate the time, and I appreciate our engineer, Dave Campo, and you for listening. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.